Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology. And today I'm delighted to welcome back Dr. Jan Islam. You're most welcome, sir. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. Thank you very much, Paul, for the invitation.
Yeah, it's great to have you back, actually. For those who don't remember, Jan is a scholar in Islamic studies, specializing in Islamic political thought. He's researched and taught at several universities, including the University of Oxford and King's College in London, and his recent publications include his book, this is the one, Islam and the State in Ibn Taymiyyah, Translation and Analysis, well worth getting, and his forthcoming book, Project, examines the pre-modern origins of divine sovereignty in classical Islamic sources, sciences even. Now, to the topic, in Bangladesh last month, an interim government led by Muhammad Yunus was formed. This was on the 8th of August, following the resignation of Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina on the 5th of August, amid nationwide student and public protests against the government. And I think it'd be really helpful if we could first of all look at a summary of what actually happened before we go into a more detailed analysis, if that's all right.
Thank you very much, Paul, for the invitation once again. And I specifically want to thank you for inviting me to speak about this issue, which, despite not being my area of expertise, admittedly, it is, I think, in a part of the world, Bangladesh specifically, and the significance of the events, I feel, are they're a bit underrated, in the sense that Bangladesh, perhaps because of its geographic location and just its size, etc., doesn't get the attention that it often deserves. And I think that the significance of the events there calls for a more thorough analysis on what exactly happened, and also what the rest of the world can learn from Bangladesh. So the first thing to discuss is, I think, it's important to understand, right, we have Bangladesh, it's relatively, a new country, gained independence in 1971. But to understand, exactly the events now, I think it's important to look a little bit into, the history, or, the events that built up to it. And so basically, what's important, I guess, first to identify is that, Sheikh Hasina is preceded by her father in establishing attempting to establish a one-party dictatorship in 1975, shortly after independence. And he was very shortly assassinated by the army, and he had a different system. This continued, you sort of had back and forth in terms of different regimes, until 2009, where Hasina took power. And under Hasina's rule, basically you have a number of problems leading up to the final protest. And of course, you have protests, before this time, but they weren't as significant. You have economic crises, including billions of dollars of foreign investment and loan money that are stolen. No one has any idea where they are, or where the money is. You have rapprochement and friendship that Bangladesh has towards India. In the sense, just signing bilateral treaties, which greatly favors India, or which greatly favor India, and even cases where Indians—these are just being discovered now, so it's not necessarily like documentary information—but cases where Indians were literally deployed in the Bangladesh government. You also have, and that was always a major contention of the population, and then you finally have, I think, perhaps even most importantly, a complete intolerance to any form of dissent, and specifically any form of Islamic dissent. So we have to remember that it was just 8 to 10 years ago, it was under Hasina that the opposition party, the Jamaat Islami, by the way, Jamaat Islami, I forgot to talk about in our last discussion, and some commenters rightly pointed out I should have discussed it. I sort of tried to group it together with the Ikhwan, but I think the truth is that the Ikhwan was more inspired by the Jamaat Islami than the other way around. That's my observation or makeup. But besides the point. So you have the Jamaat Islami party leaders who were hanged one after another in a series of kangaroo court tribunals that were basically led to the repression of the party, killing people, unjust imprisonment, etc. And so the bottom line is, you have 16 years of dictatorship and repression and tyranny come to a climax with this student movement, student protest movement. And it wasn't necessarily a systematic sort of attempt to overthrow the government. It was just in a series of protests between July and August. And that was in protest of a quota. The government basically decided to bring a quota favoring the descendants of the War of Independence fighters in terms of, you know, deciding who gets government positions in the government. That's how it started, against, you know, this sort of systematic injustice. And you had over just a few weeks, at its highest point, 10 million, at least estimated to be 10 million protesters on the streets. So more than anything that we have in the Arab Spring. I think the closest example is Egypt, which is about, they estimate 10 million, it's probably much less. Which literally just, you know, they took over the government and they said that we have to bring an end to the regime. So this is until now. And I think that that's all.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
I'd say, you know, most people, including the population in Bangladesh, including Muslim observers, they'll say, you know, that those are all positive developments. But then you have the sort of aftermath of that, the last 1.5 months that people don't really know about necessarily.
Well, exactly. And that's why we've got this interim government now, haven't we, so-called, led by this Nobel Prize winner, Mohamed Yunus, who's, I think, very popular with many of the students, at least what I've seen on Al Jazeera anyway. But can we move beyond the kind of Al Jazeera-like political analysis of the event? You're going to have a very succinct summary there, to a more Islamic analysis, a more Islamic perspective. We've had a revolution, so-called, but how does it compare with the Arab Spring revolutions that we have seen in the past? And what connection does this current revolution have with Islam, if any at all, their relationship?
In comparing, I mean, one of the things I think that struck me is when you talk about popular revolutions in general, especially the Arab Springs, those that sort of culminated from, I mean, there were definitely Muslims and people with sort of Islamic beliefs and ideas, etc., within the protest, student protest body. But overall, the body of the sort of conglomerate of the student protest leaders and their aims were phrased and articulated within the liberal, democratic, and a very secular sort of worldview. And so this is to say that you have many, just like in the Arab world, you had many sort of ulama, or you had, you know, madrasa graduates, you had some people with ties to Islamic parties involved in this revolution. Perhaps the biggest difference is that it wasn't led by a political party like the Ikhwan in Egypt, for instance. It was, although, you know, there were people outside the Ikhwan, they played a large role in it. The Jamaat Islami didn't play as much as a role as, let's say, the Ikhwan did in Egypt, in Bangladesh. But that was the point here, is that the overall narrative of the protests are sort of framed within secular terms. And for that reason, they were very happy to bring someone like Mohamed Yunus, who is a darling of the establishment, not of the regime, the former Hasina regime, for sure, but who has no problem with interest banking, who has no problem with quote-unquote secular democracy, who doesn't have a problem with the exploitation of, you know, multinational corporations exploiting the labor of or the lifeline of the labor force of the country, who, you know, sort of made his profit on or made his living and won his Nobel Prize on interest banking, which was basically, you know, sucking up profits from the poor. Beyond, I mean, I'm sort of trying to go beyond the slogans in the way that, you know, people often try to portray themselves, or beyond the optimism, which is to say that now we have the initial protests and we have the initial framing of it. That's one thing. But what's more important, I think, is to understand what exactly happened, you know, politically on the ground, and what that means for for justice, what it means for Islam. And so the first thing is, basically, you have the second the protesters went home and they sort of lost their effective control on the ground, or gave it up or put it in the hands of the interim government, which isn't really, doesn't have any sort of real, you know, military power of any kind. The first thing they did in terms of positive moves were, you know, to replace a large portion of Hasina's main sort of elite cadre of military elites, etc. But not the entire military, this is the point, or anywhere near the all of the loyalists who are sort of bought off with Hasina's bribes, etc. You have a number of university administrators and presidents who were replaced. Especially the sort of like hardcore Islamophobic secularist type university presidents who didn't allow for the niqab, who didn't allow for recitation of Quran and stuff like that on university campuses. And but most importantly and sadly, I think that the tribunals to actually bring the people for the regime of the last 16 years to justice stalled, and more importantly, they're effectively under the army's control. And there's no path forward to, you know, sort of a complete overhaul of that system. And so, in other words, unlike, let's say, Palestine, unlike in Egypt, to a certain extent, unlike in a few other places, you have a short-term Band-Aid solution of freeing the prisoners, kicking out government officials and that kind of thing. But there wasn't, you know, they're not... especially Islamic movements are not in a position to call for any systematic change. And that's largely because they don't have the ability to form. Jamaat Islami, for instance, wouldn't have the ability to form government if an election was called. And unlike in Egypt, for instance, the sort of mainstream narrative of the protest leaders in Bangladesh is that we shouldn't have an election because the system is so corrupt, it first needs to be replaced. And that's a great slogan to have. And I, that's something I, you know, I'm happy to support. But the problem is that they had a golden opportunity to seize power with a popular revolution and actually do everything wholesale. But now what happened is the military controls has actual power, and now it's just a back and forth of, you know, this bureaucratic mess of trying to, you know, possibly reform the constitution, possibly have a tribunal. By the way, the tribunal, the courts behind the tribunal are, you know, they've been corrupt for the last 16 years as well. So the problem is we have a systematic problem, I guess. That hasn't been solved.
But this is an interim government, isn't it? I mean, it's not really a constitutionally permanent state of affairs. This is temporary. There's supposed to be elections. So isn't it premature to reach a conclusion if elections haven't happened yet? No, we don't have any elected representatives. This is just an ad hoc thing because of the crisis, because of the ousting of this Minister Sheikh Hasina on the 5th of August. Mm-hmm. So what do we happen to know when our election is scheduled? What do we have a timescale? Do we have any kind of framework for the coming weeks and months?
There's a lot of talk about sort of replacing you know, government officials and the bureaucracy. There's a lot of talk of setting up a tribunal to bring the sort of criminals to justice. There's a lot of talk of even like an idea of sort of, they call it an adalat system, where they would set up like a court and then people would decide whether the person is guilty based on popular vote. Just like all kinds of ideas is what I'm trying to say, which I don't necessarily support, to be honest, but that's besides the point. You have a lot of talk about constitutional change as well. And this would all need to happen before any sort of election were to take place. And basically it's all of this is happening with two things in mind. The first is the fact the military actually has the power. The only reason they're perhaps not taking a drastic step is because they saw what just happened a few weeks ago, and they're being cautious. But also, you have the protest leaders themselves arguably shooting themselves in the foot by limiting their imagination and limiting their the set of possible solutions to the problems that exist. And what I mean by that is the protest leaders, and I've talked to some of them myself. They're very scared of the idea of being portrayed as the next Afghanistan, right? They're very scared of having any sort of Islamic sort of slogan or prejudice, you know, being attached to what they're doing. And for that reason, they're very limited in terms of, you know, even if they were to reform the constitution, even if they were to have, you know, an election that was actually, free and fair, so to speak, or not tampered with, even if they did all of those things, there are, we don't see systematic solutions to the problems that are being that exist in Bangladesh. So I'll give you an example. If we have, you know, the protest started off as a result of the quota system, right? You can get rid of the quota system and have everyone appointed to government roles based on their test results, right? Or based on, you know, their so-called merits. But what they don't, you know, what we don't realize when we think within the structures of the system is that a large portion, in fact, the majority of the population is going to do horribly on those tests because they're not able to get an education because they can't afford it. Why? Because they're working for $14 a day and they're making $1 a day, you know, in a textile factory. And so if that root cause, if the economic, ideological, and political root causes of injustice in Bangladesh since its independence aren't addressed, then we're not going to see any permanent long-term solution.
Mm-hmm. That's very disturbing. So perhaps we can broaden this out for the moment. What is the significance of all this in terms of the Ummah? In other words, what some people might call an ummatic perspective on Bangladesh. And how does this translate into intellectual and social relationships with the rest of the Muslim world? Mm-hmm. Your reading of events doesn't sound very positive, very optimistic.
I would say I'm very much, you know, there's a beautiful tradition of the Prophet, peace be upon him, that there is no bad luck in Islam. Like, there's no belief in bad luck. In other words, it's not good to be pessimistic, but rather I am pleased with optimism. Fad. And I always, you know, no matter how sort of brutal or honest my analysis is, I always try to be optimistic in identifying all of the areas of potential that exist within that part of the Ummah. And I think that there are indeed many connections, many sort of unexploited opportunities, which can still be sort of rescued and sort of taken advantage of for the benefit of all. Among those is, if we think in terms of just the fact that Bangladesh is, contrary to what people might know about it, it is, they have companies, just to give an example, which are capable of basically rocket companies, which are technology companies capable of sending satellites into space, into orbit. They have, you know, projects right now that are being undertaken to develop sort of anti-aircraft, anti-drone systems, in sort of to preserve to defend the country from outside attack from India, etc. These are extremely valuable resources. Imagine if they were to take advantage of that and they were to export that to other parts of the world, especially the Muslim world. How would they? You know, we can just imagine how they would be able to work towards gaining their independence from foreign powers like the US, and most importantly, the genocide which is taking place in Gaza right before our eyes. They can have an active role in that. But in order to do that, there needs to be, and this sort of goes back to the situation in Bangladesh, which is even the opposition, people from all parties, accept and acknowledge that the only party or bloc which was historically capable of governing Bangladesh was the Jamaat Islami. But if you ask the Jamaat Islami, they are deliberately taking an apolitical role in this in the situation, whereas they had the power, or they have, and they still have the potential of basically igniting a popular revolution that would actually change the system in its entirety. They have the numbers, they have, you know, the support, they have the value system, and they could actually show the country and outside of the country what it means to be a just Muslim nation.
You say that this party has the support, it has the numbers, it has the values. So it sounds as if all the constituent elements are in place. So what's not happening? Why isn't this being translated into actual governance? Now, I appreciate that this, you know, we've had Sheikh Hasina disappearing just over a month ago. And everything's in a very, it strikes me just watching, you know, videos on Al Jazeera and so on, everything's in a state of flux, perhaps in some uncertainty. People are being replaced, new people are being appointed. We don't have a general election date yet. So there is this sense of uncertainty in many ways. But given what you've said, this is a very optimistic thing, isn't it? Potentially.
Yes, there is a huge potential. And I would say it's not only in Bangladesh, but in many parts of the world. You can see that potential. The problem is that we're often confined by our own sort of mental obfuscation, in the sense that if we limit our, if we, if we, if, Jamaat Islami, for instance, actually formed government with the BNP, with the Bangladesh National Party, before Hasina took power, and they had ministers in the government. What I'm trying to say is they worked within the system structure for a very long time. And it's gotten to such a point where they're unable to see a solution outside of that system. They're doing that partly out of fear of reprimand, partly because I think, since the 1970s and the 80s, after the Jamaat and after the Muslim Brotherhood encouraged participation in the democratic system. And they did that, with their own sort of, according to their view. But what's important is that even where they were successful within the system, the best example is Muhammad Morsi, there was a wide understanding in the community, among the scholars, among public intellectuals, who were saying that Muhammad Morsi, look, you won the election, you have the support of the people, but this isn't going to last. Because if you work within the system, which he has, and he was successful within that system, your enemies are going to start working outside of that system. And so what we don't realize is that if we're trying to bring something good within, or we're trying to bring justice within a fundamentally unjust system, then even if you are successful, you do everything by the book, you do everything according to the quote-unquote legal method, it's not going to happen. And the simple fact is that in Bangladesh, you don't have a just legal system. You don't have a, and this is something that everyone acknowledges as well. But the problem here is that there's this great fear among everyone, including, I'll give you another example of a group. There's a group called Hafazat Islam, which was very vocal during Hasina's sort of rapprochement with Modi in India. Basically sort of a group of madrasa graduates from the Diobandi school who were basically calling for, toppling of the regime for its, reproach with India due to secularization, etc. You ask the Jamaat as well, they're very much, despite the changes, despite the fact they were able to see the change in front of their eyes, they're very cautious of taking any steps because they're saying, look, Anyone who is involved in the political system right now is going to be sort of, they're going to let them make the mistakes, in other words, and then, maybe we can offer an alternative later on or in the long term, which is, as someone who doesn't live within that system, I can't comment on the details. But what I can comment on is that if you look at the history of any systematic revolution, any systematic change in government, it never happened through, handing out roses and, democratic elections of any kind. And that's something that, I think that we should be sort of honest to ourselves in accepting, and we shouldn't be embarrassed about, because the United States has absolutely no qualms invading a country when it doesn't agree with its worldview. Russia has no problem doing the same. Israel has no problem committing genocide on 2 million Muslims in Gaza as we speak for the last almost entire year. They're doing everything, but because they're sort of they're in charge of the narrative, in the sense that the second you work outside of the system, they'll accuse you of being undemocratic, they'll accuse you of being all of the things that they're doing themselves. And if you allow yourself mentally to sort of dictate your domestic policy and your legal system and justice system and even PR, public relations, according to the mental structure that they gave you, or according to the way that they classify you, then you're basically playing within the game, and that's never going to lead to a change.
Can I just broaden this out for a moment to ask about the global situation here? You rightly mentioned the situation in Gaza with the genocide that's going on. Some have said that this catastrophe is having an effect on the global Ummah. Is it having this effect? Is it having the sense that the Muslims now are looking beyond their more narrow nationalistic concerns of this country, mm-hmm. that country, more to a more ummatic, to use this mm-hmm. word, ummatic perspective? Is there a sense of looking to the Ummah as such now, the Ummah's interests, the Ummah's role as an Ummah globally, rather than this particular small mm-hmm. statelet, which is usually a post-British imperial construct, post-colonial state. Mm-hmm. Are we seeing this rising of awareness, this globalization of an ummatic perspective?
Thank you very much for pointing that. I would say definitely look anywhere in the world, ask anyone in any university campus, you see definitely a move towards identifying and understanding the political events anywhere in the world from an Islamic or from an Ummatic perspective. And so the very fact that even the secularists in Bangladesh, for instance, are thinking about, you know, they have Afghanistan on their minds. What does Afghanistan have to do with Bangladesh? That's your question. But that's even on, it's even on their minds. It's on India's minds. It's on the US's minds. And I think since 9/11, there's been, you know, the immediate post 9/11 sort of repression of Muslim communities through the terror laws, through invading several Muslim countries, and et cetera, military intervention. There was for a while, for about a generation, a major, you know, even where Muslims had that Ummatic identity, they were often afraid to articulate it, whether it was on campus or whether it was somewhere else, out of fear of repression, out of fear of, you know, the fact that the state has no problem taking action against you, even if you're working within the within the realm of the law. And now you have this sort of post 9/11 generation, which is saying, you know, wait a second, why am I allowing for the 2004 Rand report on civil democratic Islam? Why am I allowing them to define what it means as what it means to be a Muslim? Right, that's something that I should be able to define.
Yeah, no, this is very true. And but we still are seeing this repression, particularly in Europe. It's very difficult to articulate pro-Palestinian protests in places like Germany and France, and in the UK, there's some leading Muslim political figures have been. That their political activity has been banned in the last 12 months as well. So we're seeing this ongoing, sometimes soft, sometimes hard state repression, even in the so-called free West. But if we are seeing this increasing awareness of the Ummatic context, I mean, this is very hopeful. I mean, there are nearly 2 billion or over 2 billion Muslims in the world. And this is a... If we were to unite in some transnational sense, my mind boggles as to what might happen. Now, ultimately, of course, this is all to do with Allah's will, and the return of Islamic governance, of course, is prophesied in Sahih Hadith. So this is not just utopianism. This is grounded in theological reality. But this is potentially very exciting, isn't it? A time to be alive as well.
I think it is. And I think that specifically, you know, when you look at the subcontinent, you have the prophecies of the Ghazwatul Hind, you know, the battle in India, which sort of results and culminates in the rise of the Mahdi, in which in various traditions of various authenticity. But the point here is, if you look at the if you identify the colonization of the Muslim world, right, including India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, including the Arab world, as, you know, sort of hitting rock bottom, and the secularization of society, and, you know, extreme repression, like you saw, for instance, in Turkey the last 100, or especially 100 years ago after the fall of the Khilafah, now there's sort of you're moving up. In other words, like, you know, you hit rock bottom now. There isn't much more rock bottom that you can hit. You're moving up, and the fact that the West has to contradict its own legal system to repress Muslims in its own country, taking away their children with child services, or you know, literally barging into and arresting people in academic conferences, like you saw in Germany, you know, stopping people taking their phone and their computer under Schedule 7 in the UK, and many more examples. The fact you're seeing that more means that there is an uptick in this you know, in Ummatic activity, that you know, the powers, the status quo powers, feel that they need to stop.
It's very exciting, and I always try and remind myself in this, there are others who are not Muslims looking on, actually, hopefully, at these developments. People who don't want a militantly secular godless world actually are looking for some theocentric understanding of a vision of society, even if they're not Muslims. They appreciate emphasis on justice, on healthy values, godly values, family values, and so on, and look to it with hope, even though that hasn't materialized quite yet. Okay, well, maybe we can just perhaps conclude really with some final perspectives on Bangladesh from an Ummatic perspective. What is it think that we as non-Bangladeshis can take away from this? What should we be looking for? What is our interest really in keeping an eye on what's going on in Bangladesh?
I think that the two things the entire world can take as a lesson from what happened in Bangladesh, in addition to the fact that any Muslim can, you know, advise them and help them in whatever way possible. Besides that, in terms of looking at the potential for political change in the Muslim world and outside the Muslim world, you have preparation, the importance firstly of preparation, and also potential. So the potential part is easy. The fact that you had literally just completely unplanned, in a matter of weeks, they managed to get 10 million people on the streets and completely overthrow the regime, despite the fact the military was literally, you know, shooting and killing people on the streets in cold blood. That shows you that there is a massive potential. All it needs is people willing to do it. Right. That's the first point. Yeah. The second point is preparation. You can have the potential and you can realize that potential, but if you don't have a long-term goal of saying, look, we're going to do this, and once this change actually happens, these are the steps we're going to take to establish a just system. These are the values that we believe in. These are the morals that we seek to implement, whether it's in government or it's in our homes. If you develop that systematically in the hearts and minds of the ummah, then only then will we be able to take advantage of future potentials. My goal, you know, from this talk is not to say that look what happened and, you know, we should feel pessimistic about it, but rather it shows us the potential, but it also shows us the preparation that we need to have. And this is also in the Quran and the Hadith, you know, the idea of preparing and being ready for, you know, war with the enemy, or being ready for you know, when you go for the Hajj, you have to prepare all of your belongings. And in Surah Al-Baqarah, Allah says, you know, prepare, and the best preparation is taqwa. Right? Fear of God, that is the best preparation. So we shouldn't see our taqwa as just preserving our religion within, you know, an oppressive system and, you know, holding on to it, but we can see it as a potential vehicle for change. In the Ummah.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you very much indeed, Dr. Jan Islam. And I know you have an interesting academic future to yourself, which you talk about in perhaps future podcasts and social media. But thank you very much indeed for absolutely fascinating analysis, political and Islamic. Not that those two are separate, but the overlap analysis of what's going on in Bangladesh and an ummatic perspective. There's a new piece of jargon here, the ummatic.
That's view. It. I actually have a paper coming out with ummatic soon, so I might as well advertise that.
Yeah, right, good. And I'll link in the description below to some of your other academic work so people can follow up on that too. So thank you very much indeed, Dr. Jan Islam.
Thank you for the invitation. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you. Until next time.